Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And we'll probably end up in chapter 6 before we're done. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Solomon looking for meaning and purpose under the sun in this world. So far, he's striking out. Everywhere he turns, vanity, futility, emptiness, meaninglessness, he says. But he hasn't given up searching. Tonight, though, he takes time to respond to those who think perhaps he should give up, or not give up, but stop. Tonight, he's going to respond to those who believe, Solomon, maybe you need to slow down. It's possible you've already found what it is you're looking for, and you just don't realize it. Glance down to chapter 5, verse 10. It's a preview of where we're going this evening. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Money is not the meaning of life, Solomon says. Money can't buy happiness. And in fact, money is more likely to buy frustration than anything else. Money doesn't make life easier, is the point of verse 10. But wait, haven't we covered this part before? Hasn't Solomon already done this investigation? Hasn't he already revealed his findings around this particular research project? Hasn't he already tried to find meaning in wealth and possessions? Yes. What we just read in chapter 5, verse 10 is not that different than what we find in chapter 2, verses 4 through 8. Go ahead and glance back there if you don't mind. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kind. Yes, Solomon has already covered what we read in chapter 5, verse 10. He's already figured out that the answer to the meaning of life isn't money. But Solomon's a businessman. He just told us. We know that he built the temple, but he built houses, had servants, ruled over a whole country at the height of its power and influence. He knows a thing or two about doing business, which means he knows a thing or two about sales. He knows how to respond to objections. Any sales class you've ever been to, any book you've ever read, talks about responding to objections that the buyer might have, or better still, anticipating the objections and addressing them before they even come out of the buyer's mouth. The rest of this chapter is Solomon responding to objections. He knows, having said back in chapter 2, money isn't the answer. But he also knows that there are going to be people who jump up and down and say, but are you sure? Are you absolutely sure, Solomon? I mean, okay, if money can't buy happiness, can it at least buy the things that you can use to get you to happiness? So starting in chapter 5, verse 10, Solomon returns to the subject of money, but with the goal of answering objections. Yeah, I'm sure money is not the meaning of life. That's not the answer. That's not the purpose. That's not what's in the middle. He's sure of that, and he's going to give us five reasons why he's sure. Once again, verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Money may not be the most important thing in life, many people say, but it's way ahead of whatever's number two. No, I don't think so, says Solomon. Being richer doesn't make life easier. That's his first point. The first response to those who would argue with him, neither money nor the things money can buy guarantees satisfaction, ease, contentment in this life. And it's not just unbelievers who fall into the trap of thinking that it will. You know, every chapter along the way, we've looked at believers and how you and I as believers in Jesus Christ can stumble into the same misconceptions that Solomon pursued or those that Solomon encounters. fell into. Well, here too, we can go down the same blind alleys that Solomon is describing. What we haven't touched on as much, though, is the way, not just the way that we do that as individual believers, but how we can do that as churches. I've got a friend who's a mega church pastor, pastors a church of many thousands. He's told the story I'm about to tell you at conferences, so I'm not telling tales out of school. I'm not embarrassing a friend. But he's told the story about how he chased ministry the same way that Solomon is talking about people chasing money. He had a sanctuary that held 800 people and had two services. So he had a couple thousand people in his church. That's a lot. But that wasn't enough. He had three services and four services, and then he went to multi-sites and was video simulcasting across multi-sites. He was on radio, much like we have a radio station here in town, but that wasn't enough. He got on local access cable and then on paid cable and then on internet cable. He wrote a book. He self-published a book, but that wasn't enough. He needed to find a publishing house, a real imprint to carry his book, and then he hired an agent so his books could have national distribution. He was speaking at men's retreats the way that a lot of pastors do, men's retreats, and he and his wife would do couples conferences, but that wasn't enough. They started booking cruises so that they could attract a national audience for their marriage ministry. They had a small school in the church, but that wasn't enough. They pursued having an accredited college. And the problem is, he tells the story, and much more eloquently than I do, because it's his story. The problem that he describes speaking to pastors is that once you start running that race, there's no finish line. There's nothing to tell you when you've arrived in ministry. There's nothing that signals when you've come far enough, when you've made it. Someone has always got more. Someone has always done more. Someone is always doing what you're doing, but more of it. So you do more, and you do more, and you do more. And the moral of the story is the same as Solomon describes for us. I've heard him on more than one occasion look at a room full of pastors and say, "Be careful, pastor. You're chasing the wind. More money, more possessions, more power, more fame. None of it makes life easier. It also, here's Solomon's second point, it doesn't make things simpler." He's making a different point here. Easy and hard is different than simple versus complex. He says more money actually makes life not just harder, but more complicated. When goods increase, verse 11, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? Now, there's a couple ways we can read this. The first is to understand Solomon to be saying with more wealth comes added expense, which is true. You reach a certain threshold of income, a certain threshold of accumulated wealth, and you need accountants and lawyers and bankers. Lawyers to keep track of your accountants and accountants to audit your lawyers. It becomes expensive. I remember, I was never wealthy, but I remember running a business and the number of different professionals that we paid every year just to stay in business. And I remember talking to my accountant, one of those professionals, the first year I was away from business and in full-time ministry. I sent him all my tax information. He called me up and he said, "You didn't send me any of your overhead expenses." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, legal fees and this kind of fee and that kind of fee and expenses for that and charges for that." And I said, "Didn't have any." He said, "What do you mean you didn't have any?" He said, you're missing thousands of dollars of write-offs that you used to have." And I said, "Yeah, but I'm missing thousands of dollars of income that I didn't have. So I'm missing thousands of dollars of taxes that I used to have. It's fine. It's good. It's better." The other way to read verse 11 is the more money you have, the more people you have hanging around, wanting you to help them out, expecting you to help them out, holding their hands out. Lottery winners encounter this. The statistics are staggering. The number of million-dollar, multi-million-dollar lottery winners who very quickly burn through all of their winnings because of the amount of it that they give away, not always wisely. Generously, sure, but not always practically or even lovingly. Professional athletes encounter this. Professional athletes like Allen Iverson, a name some of us might remember, NBA basketball player for the Sixers, flat broke, made millions upon millions of dollars in his career, flat broke. And he tells the story about traveling with this entourage of people who had needs, and their family had needs, and their family of family had needs, and the friends of their family had needs, just siphoning it off. Solomon could be saying either thing, or he could be saying both things. The more money you have, the more people who expect you to support them or help support them. Then again, you see the same phenomenon in ministry. The second way of understanding it shouldn't be a problem if we're doing ministry well. People hanging around, we get to bless them, we get to love them, we get to serve them, as long as we're doing it biblically, as long as we're remembering that Paul taught Titus, you know, support the widows who are really widows. Not everyone who comes to the door wanting gas money to El Dorado is somebody that the church should be supporting. I've said before, I don't know why everyone wants to go to El Dorado. Hang around the church sometime. The people who come by, it's always gas money. It's always because of a family thing, and they always need to get to El Dorado. That shouldn't be an issue if we're doing ministry right. A pastor friend of mine, had a great response for people who came by looking for money. He'd say, well, have you talked to your pastor? And 8 times out of 10, they'd say, well, we don't go to church. And he said, well, start coming to church here and be part of this family and love and be loved and serve and be served. And that's what family does. But that's what family does. And our resources are primarily for our family. So, but, you know, for our family, and as the Lord leads us prayerfully to reach out, to bless, to minister to the poor, we shouldn't have to worry about people who have needs, who are asking us to help, because God should help us discern the true needs from just the hangers-on. The first one, though, the first way of reading verse 11 is definitely an issue for every ministry I've ever been associated with. You know, the bigger you are, the more you need. You get to a certain size, well, you better have an accountant on your board of trustees, Pastor. You get to an even bigger size, well, you need a lawyer on your board of trustees. I actually was reading something this week that was advising, and this was obviously not directed to our church, but advising pastors of very large churches, well, you really need 2 lawyers. On board, so they can serve as check and balance for one another. They can keep an eye on one another. I never want to pastor that church. Even smaller churches, though, it's interesting. A friend of mine was involved in a church plant in Connecticut, and they undertook what I guess is called a launch strategy. For 6 months, they had all kinds of outreach events. They showed VeggieTales movies in the park, and they had different gatherings in malls, and they brought in Christian worship leaders, Christian recording artists, and other celebrities. And so the first day they opened their door, to 300 people, which sounds great. Wow. The very first day they have church, they've got a bigger church than we do. That's fantastic. It was horrible. Because they had the needs, they had the demands, the expectations of a 300-person church. They had 6 people who were on their entire team of servants, leadership team, ushers, hospitality, children's church, worship. They had 6 people who were launching this church. 6 people can't support the needs and expectations of a 300-person congregation. Even smaller churches go through this. You get bigger, and there are expenses that you never would have anticipated. I remember the church that I used to serve at. My pastor showed up 3 weeks in a row. I noticed that every week he was wearing a new shirt. I said, someone give you a gift card to go buy new? What's with the new wardrobe? Like, you're really going all out. He said, well, yeah, we're recording the video to the internet in high definition, and my shirts were bleeding on the camera. Really? that's a thing we budget for in ministry now. That's why we don't post our videos on the internet. I'd need a new wardrobe. Having money makes things harder. It makes them more complicated. Third point Solomon has. Money can make things more frustrating. Verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. My pastor, when he was bivocational, when he was planning his church, worked in drywall. It's a trade that he learned from his brother-in-law when he was a young pastor with Rawl Resound in California. And he will tell anyone going into ministry, whether your goal is to go to ministry, into ministry full-time, vocationally, or otherwise, work in the trades. And he's got a whole list of reasons, but high on the list is that it's scalable. You know, you start off planning a church or you start off serving in a church and there's not a lot to do. You can go work 40 hours a week. But as the church grows or the ministry grows, you can drop to 30 hours a week, 20 hours a week, 10 hours a week. Hey, you've got some extra time, go pick up 20 hours a week. Working in the trades tends to be scalable like that. The other advantage, though, and on point with what Solomon says in verse 12, one great advantage to working in the trades is you can leave work at work. I know pastors who work blue-collar jobs. One friend of mine is an accountant for ADP, the big payroll company. He would love to go half-time, 15 hours a week, part-time, any version of part-time at this point, because his church has grown. The demands of the body are significant. The church can't support him completely, but they could support him partially. The problem is his role with ADP is binary. He can work 50 hours a week or 0 hours a week. They're okay with either answer. They're not okay with anything in between. And the frustrating thing about it is that it's not just 50 hours a week because he's in a management role. He can't leave work at work. It chases him. It emails him. It texts him. It calls him. Nothing more frustrating than a job that you can't get away from if that's not your calling, if it's not the place that God has you. John D. Rockefeller, first true billionaire, perhaps since Solomon's day. When he was my age, he was making $1 million a week, and that's when $1 million was real money. And he couldn't eat. He lived on milk thinned with water and broth and crackers because his digestive system was twisted up in knots, worrying about all the money that he had, where it was going, who was watching it, what was happening to it. Was he going to have more of it? And I don't know anyone that rich or close to it. I don't think any of us do. But I've got a friend here in Wichita. Has an expensive house that he built over east towards Goddard. I've had dinner with him where three or four times during the meal, he pulls out his phone to check the security system in his home. Scrolls through, looks at all the cameras inside the house, scrolls through, looks at all the cameras outside the house, scrolls through, looks at the cameras on the poles facing the house. This is in a 1 hour, 90-minute dinner. He's so worried about what might be happening to his dream house. Money brings with it worry and frustration. And same thing in ministry. I remember speaking at one church, and it wasn't a Calvary. The assistant pastor, I saw him back, and while I was teaching, the assistant pastor of the church was kind of going like this. I figured out what he was doing. He was counting. And he didn't do it while I was there, but I was told that not only did that church count the attendance, but they quick counted the offering while service was going on. And if it didn't cross a certain threshold, there'd be a second offering before anybody was allowed to go home. It's the same thing Solomon's talking about in verse 12. It's a ministry, a family, an individual can get so overextended, can get so invested in what they're spending money on or what they need to spend money on, they can become paranoid. priorities out of whack. And really, by the time you get to that point, your priorities have been out of whack for a while, right? And the problem isn't money. Scripture's clear. Solomon understands the problem isn't money, it's our attitude toward money. It's not money, but the love of money that's the root of all of our issues. I think Wesley was onto something. John Wesley said, make as much as you can, save as much as you can, give as much as you can. And I don't think that's perfect, but I think it's better than the approach a lot of us take. I always remember Pastor Chuck, a story that he told about a young nursing student who, beyond her tithe, took it upon herself to support a missionary in China. And when she graduated from nursing school and began working as an LPN, she had a little bit of an income, so she took on another missionary, and she was supporting two missionaries to China. And as her career progressed, she got more responsibility. She became an RN later. She got entrusted with more responsibility. She became a charge nurse at one point. And every time she got promoted, rather than getting a bigger house or a bigger apartment or a newer car or newer clothes, she would take on another missionary and another missionary and another missionary. I know some people who have done that with child sponsorship organizations, you know, World Vision and so forth. You know, it took Rockefeller years to figure that kind of thinking out. That if he wanted his digestive system to work right, he needed to worry less about making money and keeping money, and he needed to focus on giving it away. Once he did, he lived to 98 years old. And at age 98, he was a happy man because he focused not so much on the getting and the keeping as on the giving. Verse 13, fourth objection Solomon wants to answer. He says, money's not the same as security. Money doesn't make life easier, simpler, more peaceful, and it doesn't make life more secure. There's a severe evil which I've seen under the sun, verse 13. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt, but those riches perish through misfortune. Life is uncertain, he's saying, even for the rich. Best friend from high school was a dot-com millionaire for about 9 months. And then the dot-com bubble burst. And went back to shopping at secondhand stores like the rest of us because stock markets crash. A lot of us know people who got hurt in 2008 when the real estate bubble burst. There was an article this weekend about families down south that bought acres of forest, and their plan was to plant trees that would be harvested by the time their kids were going to college. They were investing in commodities, in hardwood timber. Not worth anything. They were millionaires on paper counting their trees before they grew. I knew one person who didn't trust banks for all the kinds of reasons that we're talking about. So he kept all of his money in cash. And I kid you not, his house burned down. But the tragic thing is the decisions that people make, believing that they're secure. No such thing, Solomon says. Churches too. Shortly before my family and I moved to Wichita, the church we were serving at fell victim to this. We undertook a $2 million renovation project. And we did it because we had $250,000 in hand and a pledge for $1 million more that was supposed to be delivered within 3 months from a real estate tycoon. He was running a Ponzi scheme. And the only reason he parked the $250,000 with the church was the government was on to him and he was trying to launder the money. He figured, well, I need to get rid of this. I'll give it to the church and I'll take the tax write-off and the goodwill and meeting people at the church and the contacts that I'll make, that'll buy me a little bit more time to get people to reinvest to fuel this fraudulent scheme. But we'd already done the demolition at that point. So there's a church with no budget to do construction, but everything torn apart. It's not why we came out here, it's just was glad I didn't have to hang around and clean up that mess. A good friend of mine pastors a church that hired 3 new staff people, families, reorganized their lives right before the church split, made their employment untenable. A lot of churches in 2008 had building projects underway when the subprime crisis hit and had their loans called by banks. All of a sudden, the criteria for lending changed and these churches no longer fit the criteria. And all of a sudden, they're in the middle of a building project and they can't get financing. What looks like security isn't, is the point. Verse 14, riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked he shall return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. When the market crashes, when prices fall, when the factory closes, when jobs dry up, nothing left, nothing to pass on. No inheritance, no legacy. And even if none of these things happen, the best that happens is whatever wealth is accumulated gets passed on to someone else, which is great for the next generation. But Solomon is focusing from the perspective of the person who made the money. What do they have at the end of that? They had a bank balance for a little while. Then what? You never see an armored car following a hearse. Verse 16, this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, penniless, he shall go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? Dust to dust means exactly that. Money, for however long we have, it doesn't make things easier, simpler, more peaceful, more secure, and it doesn't make a difference for eternity. When you finally have everything that you've ever wanted, you still can't take it with you. Even if you manage to hang on to it, all that means is when you die, someone else gets to enjoy it, whether they use it or waste it, whether they keep it or give it away, whether they do something productive or trade it for a great big handful of wind. One Calvary pastor, you'd recognize the name, had a huge church, one of the first mega churches of our tribe. And he had a sweet deal. He had a 25-year lease on this gorgeous facility. Had a church, had a school of evangelism, radio station, everything you could think of. 25-year lease. That's a great deal. And it was particularly a great deal because Jesus is going to come back in the next 25 years. Or so they thought. 25 years came and went, and the owner took a look at all of the improvements this church, this ministry had poured into the property, rental property, but they put millions and millions of dollars into capital investment, into infrastructure in the facility, and he said, oh, this is fantastic, I get my building back now. 25 years later, those millions of dollars poured into the building. Useful at the time, but at the end of it, I can't throw stones. I was on the board of a church in New Jersey that took over a small Baptist church. And small Baptist church, like in crowded East Coast neighborhoods, it's landlocked. It sits on a corner. And it's 100 years old. It was built in the day that people walked to the church on their block. And two blocks over is another church, and two blocks over is another church. There's no parking at all whatsoever. But because of where it sits, it's worth $1 million. The property appraises at $1 million. Forget the building. Just the land, the little 16th of an acre. Except that it's zoned churches only. We have this idea, well, we'll buy this church and we'll allow the congregation to grow to a point where we can sell the building and then grab some warehouse space downtown. Nope. Just $1 million building full of wind. If you're not careful, it's easy to lose sight of what you're doing. And when you do, it's easy to end up bitter. Verse 17, all his days he also eats in darkness and has much sorrow and sickness and anger. When you realize everything you've worked for isn't everything that you wanted, isn't anything that satisfies, you end up bitter. I've known a lot of bitter pastors. Probably you have too. I've known some wonderful pastors, obviously. Pastors who, as they near the end of their race, are excited to turn things over to the next generation. Pastor Al. That might sound weird, but I'm 20 years younger than Pastor Al, so he literally did hand things over to the next generation. And I'm doing the same thing. Josh, Rob, those guys are 20 years younger than me. But I look at some of the Poyman guys, some of the pastors who have handed over their churches. They've run the race. But they're not done. They have no desire to take it with them. They want to leave it all behind. They're excited to leave it all behind. I remember one of them saying, I don't want to be raptured with money in the bank or gas in my tank. I want to leave it all behind. But sadly, that's not every pastor. It's not every parent. It's not every person, but we've been talking about ministry. I know too many pastors who have lost their passion if they ever had it. They get to a point where there's no spark, there's no joy left because they got to the place that they thought that they wanted to be and there was no joy there for them. The thing is they can't see themselves doing anything else because this is what they've been doing their entire adult life, so they just hang on. Bitter old men in the pulpit. So what's the answer, Solomon? If money doesn't make things easier, simpler, more peaceful, more secure, more enduring, what do you recommend? Verse 18, he says, here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it's his heritage. What do I recommend? Solomon says, enjoy life. He's going to go on and tell us more about what he means, but before we go there, skip the next two verses. We're going to continue in chapter 6. Before we let Solomon tell us what he thinks enjoyment is, let's hear a few words about what he thinks it isn't. Skip over verse 19 and 20. We'll come back. Chapter 6, verse 1. Here's what he has to say about what enjoyment is and isn't. There's an evil which I've seen under the sun, and it's common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires, yet God doesn't give him the power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it's an evil affliction. The end of chapter 5, or by verse 18 of chapter 5, Solomon had once again demonstrated the answer to life's questions is not money. The answer is enjoyment. Back to chapter 5, verse 18. Here's what I've seen. Enjoy the good where you can find it. But what's enjoyment? Chapter 6, Solomon says, enjoyment is not abundance. The key is find enjoyment. Where are we going to look for it? He's going to tell us, don't look for it in abundance. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy it. It's useless. Worse than useless, still verse 2, it's evil. I think of Bob Coy, former pastor of Calvary Fort Lauderdale. Talk about abundance. One of the 10 biggest churches in the country. Property like a college campus. Worship ministry, missions ministry, publishing ministry, TV ministry, all first rate, gold standard. People would travel from all over to see how does Bob run his church. I would make pilgrimages down there with my notebook in hand. Let's learn from the best. If abundance in ministry could bring joy, Bob would have had joy coming out of his ears. He would have been the most joyful person you'd ever known. And he seemed that way. The same way Robin Williams seemed that way. Both entertainers. Both secretly miserable. And again, I'm not telling stories out of school. This was, if not front page news, this was major news of several years ago. Pornography and affairs and other things. Lost everything, including his marriage. Abundance doesn't automatically guarantee joy. Continuing in verse 3, family can't guarantee joy. And that's one that'll make a few of us sit up. Family, really? My family's my greatest joy. Listen to what Solomon says. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it's not seen the sun or known anything, this is more rest than man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice. Even if he lives 2,000 years but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place? Now this is harsh. This is tough to listen to. I read it quickly because it's hard to meditate on, but this is borderline cruel. And Solomon is doing it on purpose. He's stating something in its extreme form to make a point. He's saying, even if you have a really big family, even if you live to a ripe old age, There's no guarantee you'll find enjoyment in this life. I've got friends who have big families. The pastor who scraped me up off of the floor when life fell apart. 11 kids. When the oldest was 18, the youngest was 2. My best friend from New Jersey, 9 kids. They'll tell you, you can have all of the outward signs, kids running around, climbing all over, laughing, spilling, eating. No guarantee of joy at any given moment. And what Solomon is saying is with that many children, even with many, many years in the world, all that can mean is a multiplied opportunity for pain. As opposed to, he's going to the far extreme now, a stillborn child. In Israel, in Solomon's day, a child that was stillborn wouldn't be given a name. The goal was, let's move on from that. And a name where we might say naming that child would help us remember, and the Jewish perspective was the opposite. Let's forget as quickly as possible that ever happened. Let's move on. And Solomon's point is, in some ways, wouldn't that be better? And certainly not worse than to have never been born into this world. Because to not be born into this world would mean to never have to live in this world. And to us, that sounds cruel. Never live in this world? That means never get to play or learn or laugh or grow. Solomon's argument would be, yeah, but that also means to never be sad or be ridiculed or confused or ashamed or betrayed or abandoned or alone. And so his question is, who has more joy, the person who lived or the child who never did? Solomon says, kind of a toss-up. Before you dismiss the argument, which I do, I'm with you, pause long enough to recognize that's the same argument the pro-abortion advocates have been using for years. Pro-abortion advocates have argued for years, better to have no life at all than the possibility of a hard life. And that kind of logic, if you want to call it that, pervades other arenas as well. A friend of mine and I, years and years and years ago, used to sit around and talk about planning churches, which he never did. And to be fair, I never did. But he traded ministry for something more secure. He thought this ministry life, that's just sketchy, crazy. I traded the megachurch life for, yeah, crazy. He's not wrong. I traded megachurch for this crazy family, which, like any family, has its share of hurt and frustration and disappointment. Families have loss and hurt and sadness. He's part of my prayer team, theoretically. But it's interesting. When I reach out with something hard, he's among the first to text me and say, "Be a pastor," they said. "It'll be a blast," they said. "How do you like it now?" See, every hard thing that we go through here together for him is confirmation he's better off back in business. And he probably is. The thing is, though, if you're not willing to endure pain, you'll never know joy. Lots of people's dreams, ministry and otherwise, end up stillborn. Because people decide, well, if I can't have a guarantee that it's going to be easy, it's better off if that dream never sees the light of day. Where are we at? Joy doesn't come from abundance, Solomon says. It doesn't come from long life and lots of children. Third thing, he says, it doesn't come from hard work. Some of you are looking at me, could have told you that. There's a reason they call it work. Ain't because it's fun. I don't know, this ministry is the hardest work I've ever done. I find plenty of joy in it. But that's not Solomon's point. Solomon's point is that hard work is no guarantee of joy. Hard work doesn't assure us joy. Verse 7, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. Why do we work? Most basic answer, food, clothing, shelter. Question, how many people do you know stop at food, clothing, shelter? How many of us stop when our bare needs, our necessities are met? We keep going past food, clothing, and shelter, don't we, most of us? More wages, more hours, more opportunity, promotion. Why? Because food, clothing, and shelter, turns out, wasn't really enough. So we keep chasing whatever it is that we think we need that we didn't get, something we didn't find, something that work, hard work, didn't give us. We didn't find what we were looking for, even though we were working hard, so we kept looking. Hard work is no guarantee of joy. Verse 8, wisdom is no guarantee of joy. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Wisdom doesn't put food in my kid's stomach. And I know incredibly wise scholars, pastors, who are some of the saddest people I've ever met. Makes me not want to study theology. I don't know a single joyful theologian. Maybe I know the wrong ones. But hard work doesn't guarantee joy, verse 7. Wisdom doesn't guarantee joy, verse 8. Variety doesn't guarantee joy, verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Variety might be the spice of life, but wandering from one thing to another like a dilettante isn't automatically enjoyable, Solomon is saying. For any of us, believer or unbeliever. Look around. Easy to find hardworking, puritanical churches. Easy to find wise, studious, scholarly churches. Easy to find flavor of the month, program of the week churches. And there's joyful people in each of them, but not because of their style. Sometimes in spite of it. So where do we find joy, Solomon? He doesn't know. Or more accurately, he doesn't think he knows. Verse 10, whatever one is, he's been named already. For it's known that he's man, and he cannot contend with him who's mightier than he. Since there are many mighty things that increase vanity, how is man the better? Whatever we are, rich, poor, wise, fool, young, old, we are what we are, Solomon says. Because whatever else we are, verse 10, we're human. The word there is Adam. A-D-A-M, red clay in Hebrew. Whatever else we are, we're dirt. Whatever else we are, we're exactly what God made us to be. Is he talking predestination, preordination, I don't know. I don't think Solomon would care about the technical term. Whatever it is, he's saying we're not going to change. Why? Because God is God. God is God and we're not. He was here first. He made us, not the other way around. He's greater than we are. So it is what it is, Solomon says. We can tell ourselves, well, when I get to heaven, I'm going to have a word or two with the big man upstairs. Do you really think so? C.S. Lewis says, to argue with God is to argue with the one who made it possible for us to argue. Yeah, no, insists Solomon. Better to face facts. And the simple fact, verse 12, is who knows what's good for man in life? All the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow, who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Solomon's saying, we don't know what's best. We try to tell ourselves what's best, but every time we think we know, we're wrong. I remember it was like 10 years ago, my brother found a boat. Really wanted to buy this boat. I don't know what got into him, but he just decided, if I have that boat, if I can buy that boat, I will be the happiest guy on earth. And it was like a year and a half later, he said, if I can just sell this boat, I'll be the happiest guy on earth. You know, a boat's just a hole in the water you throw money into, right? So Solomon concludes by saying the key to all of it is joy. Back to chapter 5, verse 18. The best advice I can give you is enjoy life. But I can't tell you how to do that. I can't even guarantee you will be able to do that. I can't tell you where your joy is. I can only tell you where it isn't. That's what Solomon's been telling us in chapter 6. The thing is, as we wrap up tonight, he's wrong. He already has told us where joy comes from. He's told us and he doesn't even know it. Rewind back to chapter 6, verse 2. He's talking about a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires. yet God does not give him the power to eat of it. Another way of saying God hasn't given him the ability to enjoy it. What he's saying is joy, the enjoyment that God gives or doesn't give, he's saying joy comes from God. Whether we enjoy life, whether we find joy, depends on God. And he couldn't be more right, could he? He's onto something and he doesn't even know it. Without even realizing it, Solomon's answered his own question. The problem is he's so focused at looking for joy under the sun, he doesn't fully grasp what he just said. Except it's creeping in anyway, because that's what truth does. Truth outs. And it's not the first time Solomon has stumbled into this truth. If you go back to chapter 2, verse 26, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who's good in his sight. Joy comes from the Lord. God gives joy. Solomon had that part right. Here's what he missed. He missed the part where we can reach out and ask for that joy. He's oblivious to the fact that we can seek that joy from God and receive that joy from God, that we're part of the transaction. Solomon's a little bitter writing this that he hasn't found joy yet. He's not completely convinced writing this that God isn't just a little bit capricious and arbitrary, handing out wealth and joy to the people that he likes and withholding it from the people that he doesn't. Chapter 5, verse 19, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it, to receive his heritage, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift from God. Some people are given joy by God, the capacity to enjoy life, things to enjoy and the capacity to enjoy them. Some people got it, some people don't, Solomon says. In his mind, it's like curly hair or dark skin or freckles. God's either given it to you or he hasn't given it to you. If God has blessed you with wealth and joy, well, verse 20, well, that guy's not going to dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Mark of a joyful person, they don't live in the past. And they don't obsess about the future. For the joyful person, there's no better time than now. There's no better moment than this one. Because for the joyful person, every moment's a gift. For the joyful person, every moment is something to be received and redeemed. For the person who lacks joy, every moment is an opportunity to resent and waste. Because we don't like this moment. It isn't the moment we thought we wanted. Solomon misses that in all of these moments and the joy that's available in them, it's available to all of us. He realizes joy is impossible apart from the Lord. He misses that joy is possible for all of us in the Lord. And so do so many of us. Philippians 4, Paul writes familiar words. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do things, all things, through Christ who strengthens me. What did Paul just tell us? He told us something that I'm not sure Solomon ever figures out. What Paul realized, what he expresses in his letter to the Philippians, joy depends on us. It's available from the Lord, but it's up to us to desire it and to seek it and to rest in it. Joy depends on us deciding to seek God and hear from God and obey God. And so many of us walk right by that opportunity. So many of us are intent on repeating Solomon's experiment. So many of us are determined to find joy in some unique combination of situations and circumstances. Repeat Solomon's experiment and you'll get Solomon's result. You'll come to Solomon's conclusion. Joy must be for other people. Speaking to somebody last night, not from this church, I don't want you to think that if you talk to me in confidence, it's going to be broadcast the next Sunday morning. But speaking to somebody hundreds of miles away, stuck, horribly, horribly stuck. Hate my job. Well, you should pray about a new job. Mom, my wife would never let me leave this job. Hate where I'm living. Well, you should pray about moving. No, our in-laws are here. We can't move. I said, okay, well, he said, I'm not feeling fed in my church. I said, well, okay. Is that condition of your heart, or is that something that's going on in the church? Well, it doesn't matter. You know, with 3 generations of my wife's family have gone to that church. And at every turn, I was talking to a person who hated where they were, refused to consider the possibility of moving. And every time I try to point him back to the Lord, he'd say, well, but if God tells me to, I can't move, so I no point in praying about moving because I can't move. There's no point about praying for another job because I can't change jobs. There's no point about praying whether I'm in the right church or the right ministry because I can't change ministries. And at the end of the conversation, I said, you have decided to cut yourself off from the source of joy in this world. I don't know what to tell you. Because if you won't pray with open hands, if you won't say, God, I want the joy that you purchased for me on the cross. I want the joy that should come from your Spirit indwelling me. God, show me where that joy is. I said, if you won't ask God for it, he can't give it to you. God won't make us joyful against our will. But he'll give us unbelievable joy, unimaginable joy. Joy that defies all logic or circumstance. Or if we're willing to ask him, Lord, show me. Lead me. Lead me by the hand. Take me where the joy is. We're not going to figure it out. I can almost guarantee it won't be logical. I can almost promise there's an element of where your joy is that you never would have thought of. Or you thought of so often that you were sure that it couldn't be there because it was too obvious. There will be something that confounds your imagination. The thing is, we don't have to figure it out. We don't have to reason it through. We don't have to induce it or deduce it or decrypt it. We just have to ask for it. Because in him, you know, is fullness of joy. We just have to decide we're ready. Lord, oh, we fight you on this because we want to understand, we want to control, we want it to be our idea. We want it to make sense. We want everybody around us to like it. We want a consensus. We want people to approve. We want it to be safe. We want it to come with guarantees. We want it to be easy. We don't want it to hurt. Lord, what we should want and what we choose to want right now is you. In your presence is fullness of joy. Lord, take us where you are. Bring us to where you're waiting. Lead us to your blessings. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.